Be among the first to experience Ardent Community's newest luxury apartments in Galloway, Ohio, the Pinnacle and the Reserve at Parkside Village. Enjoy spacious modern floor plans designed for comfort, style, and convenience. Amenities built around your lifestyle, beautiful finishes, thoughtful community spaces, and the perfect location. Move in now and live rent-free for 2 full months. Start fresh in a place that truly feels like home. The Pinnacle and the Reserve at Parkside Village. Call or visit ardentcommunities.com to schedule a tour or check out our rent specials.
The days are longer, the calendar is filling up, and I want to feel as good as this beautiful summer weather. That's why I've been loving Grüns. It's one daily pack of gummies that covers my greens, vitamins, minerals, and even has 6 grams of prebiotic fiber, so I don't need to juggle a complicated wellness routine on top of everything else. They taste amazing, they're easy to toss in my bag on the go, plus they're vegan, gluten-free, and HSA and FSA, eligible for reimbursement. Save up to 52% off with code PODCAST at Grüns.co. That's code PODCAST at GRUNS.co.
On the Pilot TV podcast this week, we're back in Utopia for Gillian Flynn's reboot of the Dennis Kelly conspiracy drama. We're bringing out the dead for the return of spooky BBC comedy Ghosts. And we're contemplating whether it's possible to reconcile belief in an omnipotent, benevolent God with the existence of evil. Specifically, the Mike Coulter TV show Evil, which makes its appearance on Alibi this week. I'm James Dyer, and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, a show that, if my Twitter feed is to be believed, has recruited more new Battlestar Galactica viewers in the past couple of weeks than the entire remaining population of the 12 colonies. In fact, the only people on my timeline not signing up for the Colonial Fleet seem to be the people who think I'm an absolute monster for only updating my part of the Banshee spreadsheet, a crime which, quite frankly, I really have no defense for. Anyway, joining me, Pilot's Fresh Prince of Bellend, on the show this week are my two stricken from the spreadsheet colleagues, Terry, who is very much looking forward to telling you about George the Demon later in this podcast.
Yes!
And Boyd, who has just about recovered from an unfortunate sponsorship on his other podcast, which led to him having to utter the words, shave your balls, live on air. How are you both?
Oh, God. I can't believe, who was it?
Someone dumped me in.
Yes. Yeah. I would never have heard about this, Boyd. No. I would never have heard this, Boyd, if it hadn't been for, bless them, one listener who obviously straddles the divide and listens to your Arsenal podcast as well, and mentioned, God, and I didn't know what he was talking about at first, mentioned that, why is Boyd shilling manscaping products? I don't understand. What are you talking about? And then, even better, he posted the audio of your particular read.
Unbelievable.
Ball grooming devices.
Boyd. Well, I
mean, manscaping, yeah.
I listened to it and thought that is definitely not Boyd. There's been an error. Maybe it was what he'd done, you know, how he'd edited the audio. But also, it's because I never thought I'd hear you talk about your balls.
On air.
Yeah. On air.
First of all,
let me make it
very clear. I was not talking about my testicles. I was talking about general testicles in the most general sense possible, and that you can, if you want, groom that area with Manscaped products. Yes, they're called Manscaped. I'm glad I'm getting an extra plug in for them, and it's a brilliant product, obviously, and we should never speak of it again on this podcast.
Well, yes.
Conceptual testicles is what you're saying.
Conceptual testicles, exactly.
Yeah. Imagine a metaphor.
Non-specific.
It's not a metaphor. Also, we've basically just given them free advertising, so if those people would then like to give us some money. It's an audio I like to play to myself once a day when I miss you, Boyd.
Well, if we've just about covered off the benefits of a freshly shorn scrotum, shall we move on to what we've been watching this week? Boyd, Gardener's World, was that anywhere on yours?
Very good. But I have been watching... obviously you mentioned it in the intro, but I have to admit that I've been watching Battlestar Galactica.
You have not?
And
have you really?
I have, yeah. I mean, I watched it when it went out originally, but I've completely forgotten it. I totally forgot the whole thing. I think because when it went out originally, I then got the Blu-ray box set and I watched the interminably boring opening feature-length episodes.
You mean the excellent two-part miniseries?
Well... It's very slow, though, isn't it? Even you are about
it's to not fast.
To fan,
it's
to
not
admit.
Fast, but it's excellent.
It's not fast. But once you get over those, and I think they are a slight bar to barrier, maybe to general viewers, I don't know. But once you get into the series proper, it is really great. Yeah, I mean, it reminded me. So I'd kind of forgotten that it is, you know, apart from the political allegory, just full of interesting characters, three-dimensional characters. It's just really well done. And it hasn't dated. I think even though you can tell it's not like the filmmaking isn't as self-consciously cinematic as lots of, you know, subsequent TV dramas, but it still looks fine. It looks absolutely fine. And I think, I'm really enjoying watching it again. So,
well, they've taken a kind of pseudo-documentarian approach, didn't they, to the cinematography, which I think works really well for this particular subject. Well, does this mean, Boyd, that we will now get to hear weekly updates on your rewatch as you go through it? Because that would be great.
No, because that's all I'm going to say is that I am watching it and I'm enjoying it and it's really good. And yeah, but I'm not going to go into a fucking detailed weekly rewatch.
I think you're right, though. And I think for anyone listening who has yet to make the leap, you should. They're all on iPlayer, but you want the two-part miniseries, which is not Razor or The Plan, which are TV movies for later on, but watch the two-part miniseries and then watch the first episode, season one, episode 133. So I know that's 3 hours for the miniseries and then another, 40-odd minutes for the first episode, but watch all of that and you will be hooked, because 33 is magnificent, but you can't watch it without having seen the miniseries. Sorry, bro. Right. Carry on.
And then... We had a lot of messages about Ted Lasso this week.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, and so I was a couple of weeks behind because it's going out weekly now. I caught up last night, and it has got better and better and better. I mean, you and I liked it from the start. It's like it's a really weirdly lovable. It's so sweet and kind in a cloying way. I mean, it flirts with being sentimental and cloying every now and then, but because you kind of believe in the characters and they're very well written and performed. I mean, Brett Goldstein, who plays the kind of sweary, annoying, kind of like resentful one, but he's actually a really good guy beneath that bravado, and he's so brilliant in it. It is really, really enjoyable, and kind of it's one of the. And then you think, oh yeah, it's from the guy who created Scrubs. That's what you keep remember how and Scrubs did. Tread that line between being sentimental and cloying and being very positive, having a kind of positive message. It's almost like a kind of self-help manual, Ted Lasso, for football fans. And I think that it's doing a really good job. And finally, very quickly, I just want to say the Great British Bake Off starts tomorrow. If you're listening to this on Monday when the podcast goes out, it's back on Channel 4. And I've watched the first episode, and Matt Lucas is the new co-presenter, and he is brilliant. He does a brilliant job in that role. And we could have forced you, James, to watch it and review it, but obviously it's probably not quite pilot TV material.
You could not. Oh, don't tell me there was a last minute twist and the gatto burned. Is that what happened?
There's a big dramatic moment where someone ends up in tears, but I won't spoil it.
Some sort of pastry related tragedy.
Yeah. Yeah, basically, yeah.
Extraordinary. Yep. Terry, what have you been watching?
So, we were visited this week by my in-laws. And that obviously normally means you concede a little bit of control of the remote. And I ended up accidentally watching, because my mother-in-law loves it, Married at First Sight, the Australian version. So, James, you will detest every minute of this.
Oh my God.
Married at First Sight is literally what it sounds like, which is two strangers are set up and the first time they ever meet is on their wedding day, when they're doing their vows, and they basically live together. They go through a period of like a few weeks, and then at the end they decide if they want to stay married or they want to get divorced. It's dreadful, but it's amazing. And I somehow got engrossed in the Australian version and was screaming at the television last night. And it's exceptional, and they're all dreadful, and they would all fail your Belen test, and I can't stop watching it. Yorkshire Job Centre continues to be fucking incredible. I talk about it all the time, but this week's episode was really lovely. I watched the rest of Dez, which was great to see.
Hang on, Dez or Devs?
Dez. Aww. I did not. You fucking.
I was really excited for a second there.
You two fucking wish. Come and, do you know what? Wherever I am on my deathbed in the world, come and find me and ask me if I am yet to watch Devs, and the answer will still be no, let me tell you.
Okay.
The rest of Devs, and then I watched episode 4 of Criminals. So when we talked about it last week, I'd seen the first 3. 4 is the one with Kunal Nayar. That was amazing. Those entire 4. I'm so gutted there's only 4. Why are there only 4?
I know.
Why are there only 4? Absolutely brilliant. So, yeah, lots of telly this week.
Yeah. Your man from the Big Bang Theory, let's not forget. So
your
it's,
man from the Big Bang Theory. Being indeed. Very on Big Bang Theory, yes. Like, it's fair to say.
The anti-Raj.
I think there's only 4. I think there's only 4. Because it's very it's kind of difficult to come up with an original, you know, a complete new story for each one. I think I'm pretty sure that the creators are up for doing more.
That's not an excuse.
Can you imagine? Oh, I'm sorry. We can only do a really small number of episodes because we've run out of ideas. Isn't that the bit when you're being commissioned where you have to prove you've got enough for an entire season?
I've only got four
ideas for stories, so, you know, you only can have 4 episodes.
It's normally because I've got to do them in French and Spanish and German as well, isn't it?
Well, there's
but is that
as well,
even
yeah.
happening this time?
I don't know if it is. Yeah, it's a good point. Well, they're complete. They're not. They're done by their own local, created by their own local talent anyway. So that,
you've
that's
probably also run out of ideas.
I know that the director and co-creator Jim Field Smith is a very busy man. He's also directed something else coming up that I can't remember what it is.
Do you know what?
Anyway,
the next issue of Empire magazine that I work on, I'm only going to put out half a magazine because I'm quite busy the rest of the time, and I've only really got enough ideas for half a magazine. So is that all right?
Amazing.
Oh, God. Right. Oh, well, I have watched none of these things you're talking about. I have watched all of one of the shows that we'll be reviewing today, which is quite a lot. And I've also been watching The Haunting of Bly Manor, but I'm not allowed to talk about it because it's heavily embargoed. So we will talk about that another time. However, as promised last week, I sat down and I watched Doctor Who. Specifically, the episode that Boyd demanded I watch, Blink. Which I have heard now. Just to put this in perspective, now this is the best episode of Doctor Who? Like this is, I've certainly heard it is among them. But would we say this is the best?
I wouldn't, but it is one.
I think it's up there. I would
one
say
of
top,
the best, and yeah, it's considered by most people to be one of the premier episodes.
Yeah, I would say it's in the top 10.
It's peak Moffat, isn't it?
Yeah, it's peak Moffat.
It's quite interesting to me, though, that the quote-unquote best episode of Doctor Who doesn't feature Doctor Who.
Yeah,
or Doctor, the Doctor. He's not Doctor Who, he's the Doctor.
Don't like, start fucking calling him Doctor Who.
Sorry, rookie error. There's a new error there. But do you know what I mean? Like, so this feels like this isn't a standard templated episode of this show. Like, it feels like it's something very different because it focuses on an external third party, doesn't it? And then the Doctor is a peripheral part of this story. Yeah. And I'd always thought Carrie Mulligan was one of the companions. I didn't realise she was just a one and done type, you know, she's in this. You're looking at me like I've just said something criminal, Terry.
Who thought Carrie Mulligan was a companion?
I don't watch the show. I just knew she was in it. So I just assumed. But this works really well as a kind of timey-wimey mystery. And I just think it's really fun. And I mean, it's great. It's a great episode of TV. It's scary is not the word, is it? But it's quite, you know, it's what's a word that's scary but less so? It's like, it makes you a little bit nervy,
creepy?
Doesn't it? Like, it's creepy. Creepy. Thank you. Yeah. It is creepy.
Did you actually just say timey-wimey?
Yes, I said that specifically because that is a phrase that comes up multiple times in this episode, where, especially when the Doctor says, I have found you with my, and I quote, timey-wimey detector, and he holds
you
up a
really
box.
You really have watched it.
Yes, yeah. I really did.
He said timey-wimey.
Well, this is a thing that got talked about a lot when people talked about Tenet, timey-wimey, timey-wimey. Like, why do people keep calling it that? And I'm wondering if actually it comes back to Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah, totally. It comes back to this, yeah.
But he says here, like at one point, he's explaining kind of the temporal causality of the episode, and he says, and I quote, "Time is a big ball of wibbly wobbly timey wimey stuff." Not quite Tenet level, I'm saying, in terms of sort of physics representation, but sure, I can go with it. But so I really liked it, but I liked all the Carrie Mulligan stuff. I love the stuff with the angels. I think I've nailed on a couple of things. I don't think I like the Doctor as a character, and I think that may be a fundamental problem I have with this show. I because he's quite. silly and a little bit sort of like off kilter and wacky and a bit sort of slightly surreal in the things he says. And I think I find that quite irritating. So I think maybe I just don't gel with the Doctor as a protagonist in the show. And I enjoyed this because he's sidelined quite a lot.
But the interesting thing is that each iteration of the Doctor is different in a certain way. So David Tennant's was... and had this more quirky, kooky side to him, but he was more emotional in some respects. Like, every Doctor is a slightly different take on the Doctor. So I don't think you can just say in a blanket way, I don't like the Doctor. I think you have to, like, consider each Doctor on his own, because each one is crucially and vitally different to the other.
But they're all quite quirky, aren't they? They're all quote-unquote comedy characters.
I think you, James, I think you might prefer, this is interesting, because I think you might prefer Peter Capaldi's Doctor.
Of course he will, you
because
couldn't.
Because he's miserable and takes himself more seriously.
Peter Capaldi is quite miserable and moany and introspective. He is the least probably comedic iteration of the Doctor, I would say there is. And a lot of people found that, were annoyed about that. A lot of Who fans who like the fact that it's, it is obviously, you have to always say it's a children / family show. So the Doctor has to have some levity to him. Otherwise, it would be weird. But actually, in the core years of his version, Peter Capaldi's version, people felt it was getting really, really dark and serious. And I would say, if you were so inclined, Heaven Sent, which is my favourite Peter Capaldi episode, which is his solo episode, it's just him on his own, and is an incredible piece of writing and filmmaking and acting. And you might really like that one, because that he's not fucking messing about in that one. He is not interesting. He's not wacky or but it is an incredible episode. Incredible
I think
story.
I would prefer that, because the wackiness of the Doctor does great with me. But I think part of it is because, as you say, it is aimed, I won't say young, it's not pitched young, it's broad, isn't it? It's to be enjoyed by all ages. Because of that, it lacks a certain edge and a certain bite. Like in Blink in particular, this was an absolutely terrifying horror film that has just been sort of watered down for a broader audience.
Honestly, get Heaven Sent, that's your next one, because that is not watered down in any way whatsoever. It's really powerful. Because Stephen Moffat, I think he felt like by that point is like he could do pretty much what the fuck he wanted to do within reason. And he certainly didn't tailor it. He's not sitting there going, I have to make sure this is okay for 8, 9, 10 year olds. He just wrote what he wanted to write and made sure, you know, and everyone else made sure it was okay.
But all doctors have the dialed up and down in various doctors. So if you watch the entire arc of the 10th Doctor, there are episodes which tackle specifically with the darkness in the Doctor and the need for revenge and the kind of his inability sometimes to always choose the right path and so his decisions having great consequence. And there's a couple of incredible episodes with Tennant, where he's basically grappling with that side of him, with the side. And there are a couple of key decisions he makes where if he goes one way, he basically becomes the thing he hates and fights against. And the other way is he chooses kind of the more humane path. But this brutality and darkness inside of him is a really important part of the character. There are some cracking episodes of that with David Tennant.
Yeah, true. Absolutely, yeah.
This one I liked, I think, Blink, because it was more of a straight, dramatic, sort of tonally quite dark episode. Some of the other ones of this I've watched, the wackiness, what I call the Red Dwarf factor, has been dialed up quite a lot and has irritated me a lot. Like, weirdly, I think it's the second episode of this entire run of Doctor Who, the second Eccleston one, where they see the end of the world and there's like the last surviving human. It's like a face stretched out on a frame and talking in a comedy Downton accent. And I was like, what is this shit? Like, but you know what I mean? Like, not because it's bad, but because it tonally it's not a million miles from Red Dwarf. Like, it's really just a bit stupid, and that's fine if that's what you're going for, but I really struggle with that outside of a pure comedy and frankly even inside a pure comedy setting.
Honestly, please
you don't like comedy. amazing.
Yeah, but please, God, try Heaven Sent, because I think you will like it. And I think you, Peter Capaldi is your doctor.
Your quest to make me like Doctor Who is never going to end, is it?
No.
But also classic. I always hate people. I hate Capaldi fucking people who like say Capaldi is their favourite doctor. I hate those cunts. And
well,
now
there you go. That's why it's perfect for James.
Yeah, I now desperately want to love Capaldi as the doctor.
I think I've made my point.
Oh, God.
So yeah. just quickly, before we move off Doctor Who, because this isn't actually a Doctor Who podcast, what is the best episode then? The single best episode. Ooh. If you had to put your life on the line,
So the best episode of Doctor Who, and it's also the one I've watched the most, is Doomsday, which is a Billy Piper, Rose Tyler's final episode. It's so devastating and brilliant and funny and sharp, and it's everything that I love in Doctor Who, and it's got one of the most heartbreaking scenes in Doctor Who history. Yes, you heard me. Doctor Who history.
Boy, do you concur? Is this the best episode?
It is brilliant, yeah. One of my favourites is Midnight, which is a David Tennant one with Leslie Sharp. And it's a very, very simple premise, which is that Leslie Sharp's character speaks simultaneously as the other character. She knows what everyone's going to say, and that is the premise, and it ends up being very creepy and fascinating, and that is a brilliant episode. Russell T. Davis wrote that episode.
And I will just say Turn Left as well.
Turn Left
which
is good,
is,
yeah.
Which
I think
is
I keep thinking
incredible.
Of ones that you will like. I think you will like Midnight as well. That's another one that's quite dark and definitely not wacky in any way. No.
Well, so that was whatever that segment was, he's trying to make James like Doctor Who segment.
Tried to make James like Doctor Who part 2, part 3 next week.
Shall we move on to this week's listener question, which comes from Simon Morrison? And the reason that this comes about is because he's just started, or is in season 2, I believe he said, of Sons of Anarchy. And his issue was he was finding the occasional Irish accents on it rather upsetting and asking if there was much of that coming forward. Unfortunately, I was then forced to tell him that the next season is entirely based in Ireland and also has a Gaelic theme tune. So if you're talking about hate crimes against the Irish accent, then it can only get worse from here. But something he suggested off the back of this, can you give us some examples? What do you think are the worst accents in TV?
Right, Angel's Irish accent. Oh, so we have to start there.
Oh, Angelus. Angelus' flashbacks.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel's previous life in the old country, because he's meant to be of Irish descent. I mean, what the fuck? I watched some of these clips on YouTube just to remind myself. And it is like, oh, and we're going to go down the like, what are you talking about? It's ridiculous.
They're always after his lucky charms.
Very good. Very, very good. And also, because, you know, you've got Spike, who is
he's
American, right? James Masters playing a British person with a British accent that's better than mine,
so
quite
well.
Frankly.
Yeah.
Drusilla, also terrible accent.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry. What are you, Governor?
Oh,
thanks.
Just terrible. Right? Although Kendra's Jamaican accent was pretty fucking shocking. And I think the actress said about that it was literally the day before shooting, Whedon just said to her, I think we're going to do your character with a Jamaican accent. She was like, you what?
Can you imagine?
It's just horrific.
Oh, my God. Yeah, so Buffy is a mixed bag on the accent front.
Boydie.
Well, my answer, I've realised when I was answering this question, I realised that my answer to whatever the question is every week is invariably Frasier. But this week, it's really Frasier.
It's Daphne,
because,
isn't it? It's Daphne.
Fucking hell. Not only Daphne, yeah. So you've got Daphne, played by Jane Leaves, who for some mystifying reason was given a Manchester character to play, even though she's a southerner. And if you hear her speak normally, she's not Mancunian. So she has to adopt this northern accent for 11 series. And it was completely ridiculous to decision. And it's kind of like a kind of mangled, slightly too posh Mancunian thing that just doesn't work at all. You just get used to her speaking in this bloody accent. But worse than that, though, the members of her family that we meet kind of halfway through the run of Frasier, particularly Anthony LaPaglia, as her brother Simon, who speaks in the worst Cockney accent ever, even though he's in the same family and is supposed to be from Manchester, he talks in this like mangled Cockney. It is unbearable, to the extent to which the episodes he's in, which there are many, including quite key ones like Niles and Daphne's Magic, are almost unbearable to watch because he's so fucking terrible in it. And there are other characters in her family, all her other brothers. She's got loads of brothers. Robbie Coltrane pops up in it, and he's incomprehensible, which I think is a joke at the expense of all the other actors they've had doing terrible accents on Frasier. So yeah.
Can I make a point about Daphne?
Yeah.
You see, I was, because everybody in America moans about it, and everybody always moans about her accent. I don't think it's that bad. And do you know what I think the problem is? The problem just is that she's speaking in a northern accent. Like, that's what people are annoyed about.
Interesting.
Because I find it quite a good northern accent, but I think people don't like to hear broad northern accents on the telly, and definitely not on the telly when she's meant to be this kind of quintessential British person and they've got her speaking dead broad. So I think that's the problem with Daphne, because when you watch it, I don't think it's as bad as everybody says. I mean, it's mystifying to make her northern in a US show where you just want her to sound British, and everybody in America thinks everybody speaks like the Queen. So it is an odd decision.
Yeah.
But I feel like she's unfairly maligned.
Yeah, it's not, it's by no means, is it? It's Anthony Napagli is the answer. Yeah, he is the answer rather than her. She's the build up for me to, it's more, yeah, it was mystifying that they made her do.
Yeah, it's an odd creative choice. Just to say, speak with a Mancunian accent, even though you're not from Manchester.
Yeah, so yeah, I go along with what you're saying. Yeah, I'm sure you're right. But Anthony Napagli, honestly, just find a clip of him doing this fucking Cockney, and you will, it's a disgrace to humanity. Yeah. There's also, quickly, Julianne Moore had to do a Boston accent, yeah, in 30 Rock, right? And it's like, it's unbelievable. It is absolutely extraordinary because she goes hell for leather for it and doesn't pull it off. And obviously, Julianne Moore is a legend and is one of the greatest people in the world, but that was fucking terrible. And finally, Aidan Gillen. I mean, what was he doing in Game of Thrones? Littlefinger, just in the variety of it.
It's just pick a part of the world. He does go all over the map. It's an equal opportunities accent. He's Welsh one minute, he's Irish the next, then he's a bit English, then a bit American.
Anthony Hopkins famously does in films, doesn't he? Like Anthony Hopkins, I think in that period where he was making terrible like thrillers, American
Don't
thrillers.
Don't you knock the edge.
What's the one where he plays the really rich guy who kills his wife and gets away with it? Do you know the one I mean? There's this film where honestly it's like Irish, Welsh, American, English, everything, the gamut. He runs the whole fucking gamut. And I read there was an interview with him where he admitted that he did not bother sticking to one accent because he was like, well, this is, you know, I just wanted to have a fun time.
Yeah. Well, that's just like Connery as well. It gets to the point where it's just when you hire Sean Connery, you just hire Sean Connery. It doesn't matter who he's playing; he's just Sean Connery.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But yes, I Littlefinger's accent. I think just the inconsistency was a problem there. Like people call out Peter Dinklage for Tyrion's accent. I don't think there's anything wrong with Tyrion's accent. It's just that he adopts this very RP accent in it, and I think people aren't really used to that. Like it's an unusual choice, so I don't think it's like it was a bad accent. It was just a slightly odd choice to go for an RP accent in that. You haven't mentioned David Tennant, who famously adopted a Californian accent in Grace Point. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah.
I was watching a clip of that earlier. Yeah.
That whole project was very misguided, doing an American version of Broadchurch for no fucking reason. Yeah.
But yes, the Sons of Anarchy Irish accents are particularly bad. Titus Welliver, who I love and who is Bosch, plays Jimmy O'Phelan in Sons of Anarchy, and yes, it's slightly upsetting. But there've been some great ones, I must say. Like slightly off the question, but I do think like. I was absolutely floored after watching The Wire when I found out that Dominic West and Idris Elba weren't American. Like their accents are incredibly good.
Well, more to the point, the Americans weren't they? The Americans couldn't believe it that Idris was British. Yeah,
it's incredible. Amazing. They're so good. I'm also a big fan of. It's not really a. Like, I mean, he's fucking English, but Tom Hardy's Alfie Solomons and Peaky Blinders remains one of my favourite TV accents. I just think that's genius. I love that character.
Just to say, the film I was thinking of is Fracture, which I fucking love. Ryan Gosling film, but his accent in that is hilarious. You'd love it. It's brilliant. Fracture. Go and
I have. When was it? What year was it? Do you know?
It was 2007.
I don't think I have seen that actually. Right. Any other nods you would like to give, or are we done?
Well, I was just going to say there is a terrible accent coming up in a show that we're going to review in a couple of weeks' times that you may have mentioned already on this podcast that we're not allowed to review because it's embargoed.
Oh, yes, but it is that terrible. One. I know exactly of which you speak.
Yeah, it's annoying to say, but just look out for it in a couple of weeks.
Yes, we will draw attention to it then, I assure you. Thank you, Simon Morrison, for that question. If you would like to have your question addressed on the Pilot TV podcast, then do feel free to hurl it to @PilotTVPod via DM on Twitter, and I will pick it up there. Right, time now for this week's news. And the big story this week is quite possibly that She-Hulk has been cast in the form of Tatiana Maslany, who famously portrayed multiple roles in Orphan Black. Don't know if anyone saw that, it was a very good show. And she will be playing Jennifer Susan Walters, aka She-Hulk, the hulking out lawyer in the show when it drops on Disney Plus in 2022. But that's a good bit of casting, that. Like, a lot of people were campaigning for Alison Brie back in the day, which I never, again, mainly because I mainly associate her with comedy, but I never quite saw that. But this, I totally see this. I think she'll be really good in this role.
Yeah, she's great. She was also in Perry Mason, of course.
She was recently in Perry Mason. Yes, yeah. That is right.
And she, some people actually had criticized her for that role. I think she's quite big. She's quite big and over the top in Perry Mason, but the character is, I really enjoyed her in that show. I thought she was great.
Perry Mason, which it should be said, apparently got really, really good as it went along. So lots of people did, saying that, yeah, we should have kept up with that, which I
did. It really did. I finished it. Yeah, it was great.
Really. Yeah, it's been renewed for a second season as well. But anyway, She-Hulk's being developed by Jessica Gao, who wrote the Pickle Rick episode of Rick and Morty. So that is either a sound recommendation or a cautionary tale, depending on your point of view.
But She-Hulk also has a director now as well, right? Kat Quiro, who is doing apparently this jilted bride rom-com for Universal called Marry Me, which is Jennifer Lopez. But it's interesting, I think, that they've gone for that kind of director for this. Who knows? Could be good, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I like She-Hulk. I think this should be fun. I mean, I'm here for, frankly, any of the Disney Plus Marvel universe spin-offs. It doesn't really matter. But she's a good character, and I've read the She-Hulk comics in the past. So, yeah, down for this. Down for this. What else has been happening in the world? Stumptown got cancelled. Did you see that? ABC, who had renewed Kobe Smulders' Stumptown, while we're on the subject of MCU players, they had renewed it for season two, and then apparently did a sudden reverse ferret and have unrenewed it and now cancelled it. So Stumptown is no more.
Yeah. They said it was due to COVID something. So I don't know if that means... I don't actually know. What does that mean? Why
is that in the same way that anyone can be asked anything and they can just reply with, because COVID?
It's an excuse, isn't it? Yeah. I guess that stuff is costing a lot more because you have to make, you know, special provisions and all of that, but it seems a bit much to have reversed a decision just for COVID.
Their official line is that the decision was made because scheduling conflicts came up because of the logjam caused by COVID. So it was scheduling it in when they've had to move everything around is caused, and I guess they weren't that keen anyway, so they made the decision to pull the plug.
Right.
But that's a shame, because that was good.
Yeah. I was going to mention the Emmys, because the Emmys go over 5 nights, right? Because there's so many awards. And as we speak today on Friday, as we call this, the first 4 nights have happened. So the kind of the main, in quotes, prizes will be given out on Sunday night, so too late for us. But there have been a lot of winners announced already, and I'm looking at Watchmen, I would say, is already sweeping up a lot of things. So it's won the soundtrack, won best soundtrack, cinematography, a lot of the technical awards it's getting. And shows like Schitt's Creek's won a couple as well already, and Succession. So I would say those kind of shows, I think, are looking to kind of be some of the ones that clean up in the kind of big mainstream awards when they're doled out on Sunday night.
James, I'm very surprised you haven't mentioned the Mandalorian.
Mando trailer. Yes! This is the way. Oh, where he goes, I go. Oh, it's so good. Yeah, I was very much here for the Mando trailer, especially for the moment where Baby Yoda gets scared that a fight's about to happen, then locks himself away in his little cot.
Well, well, what was that? There's a line which is like, this is not suitable for a baby or something like that. They're fully leaning into it, aren't they?
It's amazing. It's amazing. Although there seems to be a backlash against people calling him Baby Yoda. Like, apparently now they're saying, oh, no, you should call him the child. Fuck you.
The child.
His name is Baby Yoda. Yeah.
Fuck you.
But yeah, I was so I'm so excited for this to come back. I really am. It's so much fun. And it has such a great score. And there's so many cool people in the new one. Although we don't see any of the new characters in the trailer, I should point out.
Well, no, because they aren't even confirming those new people.
There is a hooded, currently. There's a hooded Jedi in it. We don't know who it is.
Oh my God.
Well, we kind of do know who it is, but it's not anyone that exciting.
oh my gosh.
But yes, I still, and I mentioned this in the Empire podcast, I refuse to buy into the idea that Mando doesn't know what a Jedi is. I feel that's ridiculous. Like, it's like, and no, just, you know, have some awareness of the world around you. You know what a Jedi is. Anyway, Raised by Wolves, not that one, has been renewed for a second season by HBO Max. So a lot of those dropped recently, and that seems to have done pretty well for them. Very excited to see Ridley Scott's slightly crazy, hard sci-fi Terry will be returning for a second
hard
season.
Hard sci-fi!
That's right. I don't know when we're getting that over here, to be honest, though I would very much like to see it.
I think soon-ish, yeah. I think it will arrive quite soon. Don't you worry about that.
Okay. Okay.
I'm excited about the fact that Jim Carrey has been cast as Joe Biden in Saturday Night Live.
That's amazing.
Amazing. Just amazing. Considering he's like decades younger. So I don't know whether they're going to, whether it'll be a makeup thing, you know, a latex thing, one of those. But I'm fascinated to see what's going to happen there. And Saturday Night Live, which is back, will be back kind of early October. And he's now shown every week on Sky Comedy, by the way. It'll be brilliant to see him. And of course, Alec Baldwin's Donald Trump, I'm sure, will be back as well.
Kind of an update to the Britain's Got Talent story we talked about last week, which was obviously all of the awful people complaining about the diversity routine. And ITV and Britain's Got Talent both came out in support of diversity in the routine this week. And also, I think Ofcom announced that there will be no investigation. It's one of those weird moments where you go, hang on. Has sense and good thinking prevailed? Has something gone as it should in this world? And it appears to have. It's kind of restored my faith in, I don't know about people because people are the worst, but it's restored my faith in something again.
Yeah, definitely. And it was interesting as well. I read one report that highlighted the fact that the complaints, when the actual live show went out on Saturday night a couple of weeks ago, the number of complaints they got after that first airing was a handful, and it was only of course when the papers picked up on it that it became a thing, and then thousands of people joined the bandwagon. And I'm sure thousands of those people didn't even fucking watch it. They just saw this bandwagon of complaint, and that's how the kind of the culture wars operate now. If something gets picked up in a paper, hardly anyone really cares about it in the real world. Everyone was fine with it, but it becomes a thing. And but good on ITV totally and Ofcom for rejecting it.
I was excited by this Emily Watson ITV announcement. So it's essentially, from what I can tell, an ITV psychological thriller called Too Close that is based on a big hit book. And Emily Watson will play a psychiatrist who gets too close to a patient. And that patient is played by Denise Goff from Stella. Emily Watson is just incredible. I mean, I've been watching The Third Day, which we talked about last week. Holy fucking moly. I do enjoy the fact that everybody's saying Chernobyl star. And I'm like, well, kind of, but she's also Emily Watson, right?
Yeah.
So she's amazing.
She was in Equilibrium, for God's sake.
But this sounds brilliant. It's directed by Dr. Foster, director, and we all know how much I enjoy Dr. Foster, the 83 times I watched it. Bruce Goodison, who directed Dr. Foster, is also directing this one. I think this sounds like it could be fucking awesome.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. And in Life, the Dr. Foster spin-off is coming up very soon. In fact, I think we'll be reviewing it next week. FYI.
Oh, will we now?
Well, yes, we will, James.
Interesting.
I'm equally exciting casting news. I'm excited about the Channel 4 remake of the excellent Swedish crime thriller Before We Die, which was announced this week. And it's going to star Leslie Sharp, who is pretty much up there, I think, as one of the best actors around, has been for decades, with Patrick Gibson of the OA. He was Steve in the OA, who had the one of the best arcs in that whole, and obviously the greatest show ever made, as the kind of, he started out as being this bully, this jock bully, who then turned into, completely came round and became a very sensitive, fascinating character. And he's going to play her son. And it's all about a detective who realizes that her son is an undercover informant in a murder investigation. And I can't wait to see those two facing off.
Is that it for news?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let us now move on to this week's reviews, and we begin with Gillian Flynn's Utopia, which attempts to reboot the entirely brilliant 2013 conspiracy series, black comedy drama type thing by Dennis Kelly, with a new American setting. And we had heard a brand new take on the subject matter. Like its forebear, this focuses around a mysterious comic called Utopia, which hides within its pages dire predictions for the end of the world. A comic book, indeed, that many people would quite literally kill to keep out of circulation. The question is, Boyd, what has this remake done to justify its existence in this crowded TV release schedule? Which, I appreciate, is a very niche joke that makes no sense unless you've seen the show and no one listening to this has been able to see it yet.
That is brilliant. Very good. Well, this show has had what you might call a complex and complicated history. Originally, it was going to be an HBO production. David Fincher was very heavily attached to it. He was going to direct quite a lot of the episodes and kind of joint show run it, I believe, with Gillian Flynn. Obviously, he directed the film version of Gone Girl, the brilliant film version of Gone Girl, her novel. Then he dropped out due to a disagreement with HBO over the budget. This is all out there. This is all been explained. Apparently, like a $10 million disagreement over the budget for this whole series. And HBO wouldn't budge and he wouldn't budge, so he dropped out. Now it's become this an Amazon Prime show. I think one of the main reasons that it was going to be more expensive, it was going to be set in the future, this version. It's now set in the present. And I wonder whether it being set in the future was a key thing that was going to separate it out from the British original. What we're now left with is very much set in the present. It keeps the premise of a group of nerdy comic book graphic novel fans who are all obsessed with this same graphic novel called Utopia. And they come together in this version. They come together at a Comic-Con style event to kind of discuss the fact that a sequel to the original has been discovered, or pages of a sequel have been discovered. And this is the most exciting thing that could possibly happen in the world. And they soon find out that there is a lethal danger to keeping an interest in this graphic novel, which touches upon global viruses and other kind of international calamitous events that seem to get predicted in the pages of this graphic novel. So it's a conspiracy thriller, kind of slightly sci-fi-ish, very much topical in the fact that viruses, a virus is right at the heart of this thing, and whether it's a man-made virus created in a lab to then go out and destroy half the world. One of the main differences, so you've got Sasha Lane is in it as Jessica Hyde, who's one of the people who's featured in, one of the characters featured in the graphic novel, and she enters into this group of nerds and kind of changes all their lives in quite a spectacular way. You've got psychopathic professional assassins who are kind of searching for the people who've got involved in the graphic novel, very similar to how they were in the Channel 4 original. In fact, they actually look the same. The casting is weird because the American costume is literally a costume to look like their equivalents in the original version.
It's so odd, isn't it?
Which is so odd.
Like Desmond Borges, who they've got playing Wilson, who clearly designed to look like a DL actor. And then you've got Christopher Denham, who looks like Neil Maskell. And it's just like, this is very strange.
Exactly. So Wilson being, I think, the most interesting of the group of people obsessed with the graphic novel, who, I mean, it's famously got one of the most famous torture scenes in the very painful, difficult to watch. And that is replicated pretty much very closely in this version. The main difference, is the character of Dr. Kevin Christie, played by John Cusack, who I think pops up in episode 2. I've watched like 4 or 5 now, so I forget which episode's which. But he arrives and he has a connection to the virus. And he is an eccentric, ultra-rich kind of, we've seen kind of Silicon Valley type billionaire, and he has a weird, he seems to live with half his colleagues and his family. And he's kind of he's charismatic and charming, but also creepy and not something not quite right with him. And he is the main new character. So there wasn't an equivalent of him in the original. So that is the main difference. And he is really good, and I'm fascinated by that character. Bottom line is, I think your response to this show is going to entirely depend on the extent to which you've seen the original. And I think, obviously, in America, where the original isn't much of a thing apart from its, you know, proper fans of proper TV drama fans who would have sought it out. And it is famously a cult thing, I think, in America. But here, you know, a lot, I think anyone interested in TV would have watched it. In America, this whole story, it's going to think, oh yeah, this is an interesting story. It touches upon lots of things that are happening. It's pretty, you know, the production values are great. The cast is really good. And they'll probably enjoy it and find it fascinating. I think if you've seen the original, it's weird how closely it sticks to the original. It kind of branches off a little bit after 3 or 4 episodes, and I say all the stuff with John Cusack's character is different, but it's still essentially the same story. And the way it replicates certain scenes and certain cast members' looks and all of that is just a bit weird if you've seen the original. So you can't, it's hard for me as someone who loves the original to shake all of that. And in the end, what's finally, my last point is, the original had such an interesting, striking visual look, these bright primary colors, stark white, a lot of white, beautifully filmed, beautifully directed. And I guess the one thing they have eschewed in this version is they've dropped that. And it kind of just now looks like a normal, very well made, high production values, but nothing particularly special. So the one thing I think that made the original so memorable, apart from obviously its storyline and characters, was that look, and that has gone. They haven't tried to stick with that. But apart from that, it's something that I think you'll appreciate it much more if it's brand new to you.
It's odd, isn't it? Like, you're absolutely right. It's that hyper-saturated Technicolor palette was really striking in the original, but also that slightly hyper-real, surreal soundtrack by Cristobal Tapia Dabir, which I love. I love the soundtrack to Utopia. And so those things are absent here, but they've maintained, or at least tried to maintain, an element of the slightly quirky black comedic sensibility. It's just more suppressed, I think, in this. It's a really strange thing, because we talked about this in the past when I first saw the trailer, and I was like, no, it doesn't feel Utopia. And you were saying, well, you know, I think they're trying to do something completely new, and that's laudable. And that would be true if it were true, but they're not. Like, they've not tried to do anything new with this. This just feels like what so many great, sort of, shall we say, cult British TV shows go through when they get, you know, translated to the US, where it's just a bigger, more American version, which isn't quite as good. Like, it's more violent, it's more explicit. Like, the torture scene you talk about is more unpleasant to look at in this one. It's much more graphic in this one. You know, and there's a she-wee scene in episode 3, which is not to be missed. And there are some really, really shocking moments. It's a very shocking moment in episode 2 and another one a bit later on. Stuff that comes out of nowhere. But you feel like those shock things are really being laid on. There's a lot of gore. There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of very casual, very bloody violence. And yes, the original was violent, but this feels a little bit more clumsy in the way it executes that. I like some of the stuff that carried over. The yellow bag, if anyone's seen the original, the yellow bags makes an appearance here as well. But yeah, and they make a few deviations. But all the way through this, I was thinking exactly the same you were, Boyd. I was like, if I'd never seen the original, I'd probably think this was good. I'm enjoying this. This is fun. This is new. But having seen the original, all I could think was, for the love of God, why didn't they just, you know, pick that up again or continue it or just do more with that? Because it was so much better. And there's even a point in this one where the camera pans across a corkboard and there is a post-it note on the corkboard that just says, call Dennis Kay. And I was like, yes, that is my takeaway from the show. Call Dennis Kay. That's what you should have done.
I mean, exactly what you two just said, which is, I don't know if you remember, but I did a rewatch of Utopia recently, which I talked about on this very podcast, and was struck again at just how fucking amazing it is and what a genius Dennis Kelly is, and the boldness and the innovation, and it just, as you were talking about, the visuals of it, the writing, it's just so brilliant. And I'll tell you what this felt like. This felt like going to see Noasis, right? So when you go to see Noasis, kind of everything's as it should be. There's the right number of people. If you stand at the back of the room with the lights off, that guy could be Liam. That guy looks a bit like Bonehead, maybe. And the sound's close enough to kind of be an approximation. But, you know, you're not getting the vibes and the chills that you get that I got when I went to see Oasis at Sheffield Arena in 2010, right? And that's all I can liken it to, which is it is a shadow, I think, of the original show. So it's visually muted. The humour just doesn't punch and bite in the same way that it did in the original. You know, and weirdly, I was thinking maybe being made and produced now and coming out into the world now, what with talk of a flu pandemic, this may feel more relevant and more zeitgeisty, and maybe it will actually have an even greater resonance than it did do originally, but weirdly, not at all. And it just felt to me like it was just a weaker, flatter, quieter, more muted version of what we'd already seen. But it wasn't even particularly cohesive, because you would have, it felt like at one point I thought, oh, they're just playing it safer, they're not taking a lot of the risks or really pushing it as far as the original. But then you'd get this uber violence and this sudden brutality, but it's playing out against this otherwise kind of muted execution. So it felt far less cohesive and daring and bold and interesting than the first one. And essentially, if you haven't seen the first one, as you say, you might enjoy this, but if you haven't seen Original Utopia, I'd say don't fucking watch this one. Go and watch that.
Yeah, I don't see
the point in this. I don't see the point. Yeah.
I alluded to this in the introduction here, but there is a line repeated by John Cusack's character in this where he says, "What have you done today to earn your place in this crowded world?" And it's just like, exactly. Like, that's the thing that was going through my head watching this. Like, this has not done enough to earn its place on my viewing schedule, even though I have watched every episode of it. I'm just like,
I did watch all of them.
It captivated me enough to do that. But I was just like, but again, it doesn't do enough with the material to warrant its existence. We already have Utopia. It's already brilliant. You needed to do more to make this earn its place. And I don't think it does.
I carried on watching it as well, but mainly because I just wanted to keep an eye out for when it's going to divert from the original one. I kept like, please, please let it go down a really interesting. And it kind of threatens to, doesn't it? I mean, I haven't finished it yet, unlike you, James, but every time it threatens to be different and new and exciting, it kind of just doesn't quite go there, which I found weird. I also, just to get a deal, like, I actually found Jessica Hyde, this version of Jessica Hyde, less convincing than the one in the original. I didn't buy her. I don't want to spoil it, but what she does in this and the speed with which she does it, if you know what I mean, I found that, I didn't buy it. I just found that a bit, I didn't think it was, that was written. I didn't think her character was well written enough to justify what she does.
Horribly misjudged. So it's Sasha Lane plays it in this, famous from American Honey, where it was Fiona O'Shaughnessy in the original. But in this one, it's like it's very hard to, and we're coming back to, it's not so much a likability thing, it's very hard to maintain sympathy with that character, because that character has always had bite. She's always been an edgy character. But in this one, she's just awful. And it's just, they seem to have misjudged how the audience is going to respond to that character, which I think, that was definitely a misstep.
I know this is an annoying thing to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. Just imagine what it would have been like with Fincher involved. Because the thing that marks him out, I think, in his whole career, you know, is being uncompromising. And I think this feels in a strange way, and I have no idea, you know, I'd love to read in the end, you know, this is one of those projects where I want to read every single detail of what happened in the making of it. But I feel like it needs a really uncompromising figure to do this thing. And he dropped out.
Well, we will never get to see what he would have made of Utopia. But if you want to see what Gillian Flynn made of it, then Utopia drops in its entirety on Amazon on Friday, September the 25th. Next up this week is Evil, a show that debuted on CBS in the States last year and stars Mike Coulter and Katja Herbers as a pair of investigators, one a Catholic would-be priest and one a skeptical forensic psychologist. And they investigate the work of the devil from their distinct perspectives. It is a demonic procedural, and the first episode features a demon called George. But Terry, is this the work of God or the devil?
This is a work of fucking genius is what it is. So obviously this is a supernatural network procedural. So obviously I'm already in from the get-go. I I'm going to cut to the chase and say I loved this and I am so desperate to stop talking to you lot and go home and watch all of the others because it is absolutely brilliant. So it's by Michelle and Robert King, who we know better for The Good Wife and The Good Fight. And as you say, it's really about these two people and the opposing roles they play in these investigations into demons and into evil. She is brilliant. So there's something, I find her really magnetic. She's really compelling on screen. Katja Herbers, obviously, who's in Westworld. And she plays this skeptical forensic psychologist. So when we meet her, she's essentially working for the prosecution. She's the person who comes in and says, you know, they're absolutely sane. Whatever they're saying is nonsense. And she's making quite a good living doing this because the backstory, and it's quite a random backstory, you have to say, is that she has four daughters, lives in this little weird house under a bridge, and her husband is off helping people climb Mount Everest, which is such a random little diversion that it kind of throws you for a minute, but that's the backstory of why she needs the money. And she's basically testifying in this case, and she meets Mike Coulter, who, as you say, is a trainee Catholic priest who also, on behalf of the church, investigates events, which are, in this case, demons. In the second episode, it's going to be miracles. And basically, he puts enough doubt in her mind about this guy she's trying to see if he's sane that she no longer feels able to say he is. She gets fired. And because of that, she ends up working together with Mike Coulter's character to make money initially, but then you see that it's kind of challenging her beliefs and, you know, making her question everything she wants to know. Now, there are you spy kind of ideas that have been explored in other things associated with religion and with heaven and hell and demons and the devil. So there's a little bit devil's advocate in there because there's this whole theory about the devil putting people in positions of influence, whether those positions of influence be lawyers, doctors, etc. And also I was thinking about Stigmata with Gabriel Byrne. He plays a little the Gabriel Byrne role, kind of having his own beliefs questioned at the same time. But there's like these actually quite interesting modern riffs. So there's this whole bit about this really bad guy, this who's a doctor, but is the devil, maybe you're led to believe. And the theory is that he's trying to link all of the bad people in the world through social media. And there's a whole bit where they're talking about how social media is the work of the devil. And you're like, I can't really disagree with that, quite frankly. Social media is the work of the devil. And there's a whole theory around kind of how the devil works in the modern world and maybe part of the chaos we're seeing and the fact that people... devil, you know, the devil in all his forms and the people who work for him can now be connected by technology. So I found that really interesting. Now, this, it actually does some really interesting things stylistically, some kind of random things, some weird things. This demon we're talking about, she has night terrors, right? And an incubus appears called George.
Not the band Incubus, because that'd be weird.
Not the band Incubus. He's called George, and it's amazing because he basically like melts out of the wall and you're like prepared to be proper scared. You're like, okay, this is good. This is the scary bit. And then he starts talking to her in this plum accent, pops his head under the duvet and starts checking out a caesarean scar. And this is weird, random, tonal shift.
Very X-Files. Very X-Files.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say is the random tonal shifts are incredible. And then you have this will they, won't they thing between Mike Coulter and Katja Herbers' characters. And there's clearly a chemistry. And I have to say the chemistry is incredibly credible. I was totally buying into that. And because of those things, because of the weird tonal shifts that you just don't think will work, but they do, the pairing of them, the kind of, you know, the belief and the cynicism and this will they won't leave, it really reminded me of X-Files. And that's really the thing that it's most like. And so there are bits of it where you're like, this kind of shouldn't work. And it's a bit weird and really fucking random, like George the Incubus. But it kind of does work. I got to the end of this and I was like, I think this is fucking brilliant. I really, really think this is fucking brilliant. And as I say, it's, the episodes are each going to go into looking at different facets of organized religion and belief, and trying to explore a different case each week. And I honestly, I'm like so bang up for this. It's ridiculous. I found this brilliant and funny and scary at times. And yeah, I'm loving it. I'm loving all of it.
Yeah, it's a surprise. It was a real surprise. Like, I knew I'd heard of it, and I knew that it was created by Robert and Michelle King, because the Good Wife is one of the best kind of network shows of the last decade, I would say. And this is a network show. This goes out on CBS prime time in America, and it's fucking weird and freaky and very violent. There's right at the beginning, there are scenes. There's some quite bloody, nasty scenes. They don't hold back, and they also don't hold back just in the fact that anything can happen. Like, you know, they're kind of set up, and as you say, it's funny. Like, the funny stuff is funny. The horrific stuff, the horror stuff, that particularly those night terror scenes with, and even though the incubus George is, it's the first time you see him, you're like, oh, this is ridiculous. But because they establish that you don't know whether you're supposed to think that he really is an incubus or a total figment of her imagination, and they maintain that very cleverly throughout, helped by the character of Ben, Asif Mandu's character, who is the kind of guy who comes up with scientific explanations for everything in great detail. And I think that's really clever. Like, he's always coming up with a reason and an explanation for every single thing that happens. And I think that's, from what I read, is going to carry on throughout the whole thing. Treading that line between supernatural and real and horror and comedy, it does it so well. Yeah, I loved it as well. I thought it was just a brilliant surprise. And then I started, because I hadn't really read much about it, but I knew it was coming. But then when you read about it, you know, American critics, yeah, saying it's the best new show of the year, blah, 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 blah. But it's really, really different. And even though it has got bits of The X-Files, it has got bits of a lot of other shows and a lot of other films and stuff, it's definitely unique. It's definitely its own thing.
It's interesting you mentioned Ben, because that's one of the things that sets it apart from that classic, you know, skeptic believer two-hander, isn't it? That this is kind of a three-hander, although he has a slightly lesser role as the IT nerd. And he and she, both of them come up with, you know, the skeptical rational arguments, and Mike Colter just like, no, 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 and goes through with his, you know, his seminarian beliefs. But yeah, like George in particular, that was very Darren Morgan to me. Like, that felt like a real classic sort of like Darren Morgan X-Files moment. I didn't love this as much as you guys did, not because I thought it was bad. It just, procedurals, as you know, leave me a little cold. And I feel like I have watched so many things, like, again, like I've watched every episode of The X-Files, and I think this didn't offer enough that doesn't. Do you know what I mean? Like, it didn't take me in enough new places. I like Mark Coulter and everything. I think he's great. And Katja Herber's character, I think, is a really interesting take on that. And I love the fact that her husband is inexplicably up Everest, because of course he is. But yeah, all the way through this, just a lot of these things felt familiar. Like, it felt like, I thought, oh, this feels very X-Files. And then when Michael Emerson comes on as that kind of like, is he or isn't he the devil? I thought, well, you just feel a lot like Brent Spiner's character from Outcast. And it's just like, a lot of this felt very overly familiar to me. That said, I do not think it's bad at all. And I certainly think for the procedural fans out there, this has a lot to offer. And it feels different from a lot of the procedurals currently airing. It's been a long time since we've had something tonally that works like The X-Files did. So some fun to be had. Just, I probably won't watch any more of it.
Well, Michael Emerson's character, and that, he really did remind me of Pacino in Devil's Advocate, right? But even the like dialogue, there's a scene on some steps, and the places his dialogue goes to was really shocking. Yeah. Some of the stuff he was saying in a glib way to prove how evil he was genuinely shocking. And I thought the writing was actually really daring in places. I have to say as well, I think Mike Colter is really lovely in this, like really nuanced and interesting. And, you know, playing the role of the believer and the trainee priest who kind of often naively believes that there is a divine reason for everything that happens in front of him. I think that could be quite a hard role to nail with any kind of nuance, and actually even make it vaguely interesting. But I think he's gorgeous in this.
And the new hot priest. What a hot priest.
hot priest. But I do take your point, James. And you know, Boyd was saying about critics saying it's one of the best new things on telly this year. I definitely don't think it is. And I think when you think about what's been on British telly this year, completely different, but we're talking about I Hate Susie and I May Destroy You and things like that, which feel really bold and new and interesting. And this takes a lot of traditional telly things and wraps it up together. But it is the fact that this goes out on network TV that seems extraordinary.
I think you're right.
To me. That, like,
it's
ridiculous.
Really bold. Like, it's really committed in what it does. And for a network show, it's really edgy as well. So, I agree with you entirely. I think the critics, I mean, when they reviewed it, would have been, what, last December, I want to say? It was a tail end of 2019. Still, Evil in the UK comes to Alibi, and it starts on Monday, September the 21st at 9 p.m. Finally this week, we have Series 2 of Ghosts, a show that we missed, actually, when it debuted last year. But this one comes to us via the Horrible Histories and Yonderland crew and sees Charlotte Ritchie and Kiel Smith-Bino as a couple who inherit a haunted mansion and have to find a way to get along with the place's undead inhabitants. This second season begins with ghost hunters invading the place and gets an awful lot of comedy mileage from the fact that one of the ghosts is called Fanny. Boyd, did you get into the spirit
of this? I knew you.
That's like, literally a bit, which is like, right. Yeah. And then we go to the Fanny shot, and then she's like, wait, is Fanny exposed? Like, they really get a lot of mileage out.
There are Fanny jokes. Mrs. Slocum's pussy all over again.
I know.
But, you know, that's the thing about this show. It will happily do Fanny jokes. And yet, at the same time, this opening episode of Series 2 had, I thought, a really clever idea of if you have got... So the whole premise is that this couple live in a really haunted house with real ghosts only she can see and she knows about. So what would happen if then they then marketed it as one of those ridiculous haunted houses that people go to because it's haunted, and then the ghost didn't play a lot and then the people felt that they were robbed because it wasn't properly haunted. But then it ended up that it is properly haunted, and maybe they'll finally realise in the end that the way marketing it. I thought it was such a clever initial opening episode. I really liked the show. I really liked the first series. It's basically a traditional, you know, it's a traditional half hour family friendly sitcom, even with the Fanny jokes. Again, bear in mind, Are You Being Served went on for years and years, 8 o'clock on BBC One with pussy jokes every fucking week, and they somehow got away with it. It's created by, as you say, the team of Horrible Histories and Yonderland, Matthew Bainton, Simon Farnaby, Martha Howe Douglas, Jim Howick, Lawrence Ricard, and Ben Wilbond. And I think they've established this tone, going back to Horrible Histories, of just a joyousness and a kind of celebration of eccentricity, a British eccentricity particularly. So all of the ghosts are funny, silly. They all kind of have their one thing they kind of do repeatedly every week, and they're kind of recurring roles. Supporting Charlotte Ritchie, I mean, she's so good. She's so... I'm trying to avoid the word likable for Terry. But she is a delight. She's just a delight in everything she does. Mm. And in this is a total delight. Kiel Smith, by now as a husband, is funny. He's kind of like a doofus.
He plays it really well.
So I just think this cast, just being funny. Katie Wicks is in it. She's great. Lolly Adefope is in it. She's brilliant. Just the great talent. Doing very British, eccentric, lovable characters. It's kind of gentle, funny, rather than, you know, apart from the Fanny jokes, actually, which are probably certainly the broadest and possibly the funniest moments, actually, of the show. The humour is, gentle is almost the wrong word. It's kind of like, I don't think you're expected to find it hilarious and like doubled up with pained laughter. I don't think they're going for that. They're going for a kind of like wry observations, and I think it really works, and I really like it.
Terry?
Well, look, so in isolation, there are lots of things about this that I like, especially Charlotte Ritchie. I just think she is magnificent in pretty much everything. The entire cast is incredible. The tone, as Boyd says, is kind of traditional in some respects, and gentle and quite warm and quite silly and stupid at times. But I don't find it funny. And that's the thing I'm struggling with, which is it's perfectly fine. And I know loads of people love it, but And the and I'm with you. The conceit is so brilliant. When they all go on strike and refuse to do any haunting stuff, and she's trying to dole out responsibilities, and he's like, right, you make the weird smell. When they refuse to do it, and she's like, oh God, the ghosts are on strike. It's the whole conceit is very funny, I just don't. It's not my kind of humour. The Fanny joke, for example, that classic, I suppose, British sitcom humour is what I describe it as. Is not my cup of tea. But I can totally see why this is so loved and why people are so warm about it. It's a brilliantly warm show, and I totally get it. And it's very British, and it's brilliantly done, but. It doesn't make me laugh.
I think that's fair. I have a weird division in this where I found both Kiel Smith Bynoe and Charlotte Ritchie both very funny. I thought they were both great, but I didn't find any of the ghosts funny. So Charlotte Ritchie has this really good thing where she plays the comedic stuff so straight and just imbues it with just something I find, it just resonates with me. I find it naturally very funny. So because she's the one delivering the Fanny jokes, absolutely deadpan straight, loved it. Whereas because the ghosts are much broader and more mannered and more sort of like quote unquote silly comedy, I didn't find them particularly funny. So I went backwards and forwards on this. So I watched the pilot of this as well to get a feel for it first before I went into this. And I enjoyed that more. I think maybe because it wasn't quite so ghost heavy. This particular one I didn't love as much, but it does have its moments, when they're trying to fake the hauntings while the ghosts are doing their best to kind of sabotage it. Like there's good comedy fodder there. It's definitely not, laugh a minute, lolling on the floor type humor. But it's nice. It's quite sweet. It's quite comforting. I can see why it's really popular, because it's the kind of comfort blanket comedy that I think, that we in this country do quite well. But it's probably not going to become an all-time favorite of mine. That said, I might watch another one or two. So there you go.
Good. They'll be thrilled.
I'll watch another one or two of those.
I might, but I can't promise anything.
It has like a sort of Beetlejuicy feel to it in places as well. Like I like that kind of cohabiting. Because ultimately this is like a house share sitcom, isn't it? Like it's a hanging out. It's just that some of them are dead.
But it doesn't have, I think like the humour of Beetlejuice does work for me because it's much more... sharp-edged, and it's much more absurd, and it's much more kind of eccentric and
mean-spirited
weird
in places as well, whereas this definitely isn't.
Yeah, yeah. You've got your caveman doing the crossword, it's so brilliant. I mean, what I will say, it's so brilliantly, beautifully British. Do you know what I mean? And the scoutmaster with the arrow through his neck, and it ruins the end of the football. And it's just, I totally get it, but it's probably a little too gentle for me.
Ghost Series 2 begins on BBC One on September the 21st at 8:30 p.m. What else is out this week, Boyd?
Well, there's a new spin-off of 9-1-1. Which was Ryan Murphy and Brad Falchuk's kind of very mainstream, hugely successful American drama series about the emergency services. And this one is called 911 Lone Star. And it stars Rob Lowe, believe it or not, as a fireman who's the sole survivor of his Manhattan fire station at 9/11. And he goes to Texas. It's a fish out of water. He's a fish out of water in that terrible British thing.
Wild Bill.
Yeah, Wild Bill. So... he's somehow fitted this in to his hectic schedule and done another lengthy fish out of water drama series, this time an American one. But fans of 9-1-1 will enjoy it.
This is following on from the FBI spin-off that we had last week.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, once you've got a vaguely successful procedural of any kind in America, you're going to get spin-offs of it. There'll be evil colon
Miami.
Up the mountain.
Yes. It'd be evil on Everest with her husband investigating things with Sherpas.
Yeah. And I wanted to mention there's a one-off documentary on Sky Arts is now available to watch for free, so you don't have to be a Sky subscriber to get it. It's on Freeview and you don't have to pay for it. And there's a one-off Danny Dyer documentary about his relationship with Harold Pinter on Tuesday.
Jesus Christ.
On Tuesday the 22nd of September, and it'll be on. You can watch it anytime you want on if you've got Sky. And
what is his relationship with Harold Pinter?
Harold Pinter cast him when he was young, when he was in his early 20s. in one of his productions that Harold Pinter himself was directing. They became mates, and he then cast him again, and it became a thing. They became proper mates, and they would socialise. And it's
what?
Yes,
this sounds
exactly,
like a
see?
Mockumentary. Is this some kind of spoof?
Yeah,
no, it's
Are you
real.
Taking the piss?
I'm not taking the piss because people forget Danny Dyer before he went did all those terrible
could
British
act.
Gangster films and EastEnders could act. He was a promising young actor who did some good stuff, particularly his stage work with Harold Pinter. And I saw him last year. They did some earlier this year in the Dumbwaiter, which was they did Harold Pinter shorts in the West End, and I saw him, and he was brilliant. He was fucking brilliant in that. So he can act. It's just that he's become a kind of big bizarre celebrity. So yeah, if you want that whole story, that's on Sky Arts on Tuesday.
FYI. That is nuts.
Yeah.
Okay. Pick of the week. What would be your pick of the week?
Evil.
Oh, evil.
Evil.
Evil. Evil is
evil.
Your pick of the week.
Evil.
Wow.
Yeah, I think so.
As opposed to what?
I don't know. I
I mean, there's only three options, right?
Of these
one of which
three,
you're like, I might watch again if I could be
put
bothered.
Put it this way. Ghost, I said I'd watch maybe another couple of episodes. Evil, I've basically said I'm not watching any more episodes, and I watched the whole of Utopia. So by that virtue alone, I've almost got to say Utopia because I've watched all of it. So there you go. Do we want to do a quick banshee before we leave? Terry, why don't you go first?
Okay. So I want a banshee Spotless. Which is currently on Netflix. It's a French show set in the UK that I think was originally aired in the US, but it's basically a bit like Breaking Bad, but with crime scene cleaners and Mr. Bates from Downton Abbey. I mean, what is not
sold
to love about this? So it's about a Frenchman living in London. He does a crime cleanup business. That's his business. His name is Jean. And you're going to enjoy my pronunciation now because he is played by Marc-André Grandet. Grandet, which I think is the French pronunciation.
Grandet.
Grandet. And he'd basically originally been crime scene cleaning legally for the police, but he gets himself into loads of bother. His brother turns up after he hasn't seen him for years and years and years, played by Denis Ménochet. And he brings bother because he turns up with a dead girl in his car, which, you know, is always going to cause a problem. And basically, they then end up crime scene cleaning for a British mobster who is played by Brendan Coyle, a.k.a. Mr. Bates from Downton Abbey. So this is all, I think there was there one season only, 10 episodes, and it's about the disintegration of family, there's an extramarital affair, about getting entangled in crime, about secrets from family past and history. And this is kind of, I suppose, peak French TV.
Très bon.
As they say in
La France.
That was a roller coaster
it
of
was, wasn't it?
I apologise to any French people harmed in the
Listen,
making of
very
the
carefully. She must say this only once. Or twice. Possibly twice.
When they bring back Clouseau. When they do a female spin on Clouseau, you definitely shouldn't get them wrong.
I want to talk about one which I was asked to talk about on Twitter, which is only made slightly more problematic from the fact that while I've seen every episode of it, I only have a very dim recollection of it. But this is Terra Nova, which was an Amblin show, actually. It was exec produced by Steven Spielberg, and this aired all the way back in 2011. And it was a sort of lavish, big budget production, and it was set in a future where, you know, the environment's gone to shit, yada yada yada, basically the world we live in now. And there's a maximum child policy, and the main character in this, Jason O'Mara, played this guy Jim Shannon, and he and his family, they'd broken the child policy, and he'd been arrested for it. They had one too many children, so they go on this pilgrimage through this quantum portal which has been discovered, which takes them back to the Cretaceous era. Because of course it does. So then you've got these colonists in the Cretaceous period trying to kind of, you know, start a new life amidst dinosaurs and whatnot. And then of course you've got big business who are trying to strip mine the Cretaceous period and take it all back to the future. But this has Stephen Lang slang himself as the commander of this settlement there in a kind of proto-Avatar mold, a man who survived 118 days alone in the Cretaceous period and helped build up this settlement. And there's like a faction called the Sixers who are trying to do something, and there's corporate interests and whatnot, and then they try and end a portal so the future can't come in. It doesn't really matter. Suffice it to say, it was quite good. The effects were actually pretty decent. I remember being quite compelled by the story, but it was very expensive and it got cancelled. So Terra Nova, sadly, is no more, but it was quite fun while it lasted.
Yeah, I remember Terra Nova. Yeah, it was quite a huge, kind of hugely trumpeted, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like the big show of that year, wasn't it? Yeah. Like, all the money was in Terra Nova. I was a bit surprised that it kind of died on its ass. But it was pricey.
Yeah. I was inspired by a guy called Ian Smith on Twitter. Drunken Baker is his Twitter handle. He reminded me of old Steve Coogan show, because I'm on a bit of a Steve Coogan trip at the moment, because if, in case you haven't heard it, the Alan Partridge from the Oast House podcast, which is actually an audio book which you can only get on Audible. I know Coogan was on the some other podcast, the Empire podcast. Should really have been, I think he's more TV than film. I do think he should really have been on this podcast, but I won't go on about it. Anyway, From the Oast House is the greatest Alan Partridge thing yet. It's fucking incredible. All 7 hours of it. So I mentioned that. So then I was on a Steve Coogan watching other stuff, and his series Dr. Terrible's House of Horrible was a one series wonder in 2001, and it was basically an anthology series, just 6 episodes, before Inside Number 9 and before the current kind of vogue for anthology shows. It was a different silly horror story every week. And they were kind of spoofs of classic, like Tales of the Unexpected, all the shows that inspired Inside Number 9, basically. Thriller, which I mentioned on here a couple of weeks ago. Beasts, another one I mentioned a couple of weeks ago. All of those are in it. And visually, it's kind of like, it's got a kind of 70s feel to it. And Steve Coon introduces each episode in this guise of Dr. Terrible, and who is really funny, by the way, really funny character. And it had great people in it, like Honor Blackman's in it, Angela Pleasance, Mark Gatiss, John Thompson, Simon Pegg's in it, Ronnie Anne Coney. It had a really good cast. It was really funny. You can only get it on DVD. It's not on any of the streaming services or anything, but it is freely available on DVD for quite cheap. But I loved it. I remember it went out at the time, and I was gutted that it was never recommissioned.
I've listened to some of From the Oast House.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
And it's amazing, isn't it?
Well, it's Alan Partridge, which, I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with. But I must admit...
Why are you listening to it if you don't even like Alan Partridge?
Well, we were given an exclusive clip to run on the website, and so I had to listen to it to vet it. But actually, I can't confirm 100%, but there's a very real chance I smiled at one point towards the end. So... recommendations, thanks, do not come higher than that.
Wow. That is a huge moment.
And on that note, that is it for this week's episode of the Pilot TV Podcast. If you would like to show your appreciation in the form of a 5-star Apple Podcast review, then that would be great. And if you enjoyed the show, then please tell all your friends about it as well. If you're in need of personal grooming tips, then Boyd is available to field your manscaping inquiries on Twitter and or Instagram at Boyd Hilton. And for anything else, Terry and I are at Terry_White and at James C. Dyer.
I am also available for testicle chats.
Yes, feel free to run those past Terry as well if Boyd doesn't have the answer for you.
Terry's here for pronunciation needs, definitely.
Yes, Terry will do it in a French accent. Next week on the show, we will be seeing fact and fiction collide as we witness Brendan Gleeson masterful take on Donald Trump revealed in all its glory in Sky's The Comey Rule. Plus, we'll be investigating the very meaning of life in the Dr. Foster spin-off of the same name, and you'll get to hear what we thought of Brave New World as well. Pilot out.
Be among the first to experience Ardent Community's newest luxury apartments in Galloway, Ohio, The Pinnacle and The Reserve at Parkside Village. Enjoy spacious, modern floor plans designed for comfort, style, and convenience. Amenities built around your lifestyle, beautiful finishes, thoughtful community spaces, and the perfect location. Move in now and live rent-free for 2 full months. Start fresh in a place that truly feels like home. The Pinnacle and The Reserve at Parkside Village. Call or visit ardentcommunities.com to schedule a tour or check out our rent specials.
The days are longer, the calendar is filling up, and I want to feel as good as this beautiful summer weather. That's why I've been loving Grüns. It's one daily pack of gummies that covers my greens, vitamins, minerals, and even has 6 grams of prebiotic fiber, so I don't need to juggle a complicated wellness routine on top of everything else. They taste amazing, they're easy to toss in my bag on the go, plus they're vegan, gluten-free, and HSA and FSA, eligible for reimbursement. Save up to 52% off with code PODCAST at Grüns.co. That's code PODCAST at GRUNS.co.